Echidna Charlie, contact departures when airborne, clear for takeoff.
Echidna Charlie. Echidna Charlie's got a slight problem, we'll just stand by one.
Echidna Charlie, confirm operations normal.
Negative, we've got just shut down the left engine, we'll be returning very shortly. Echidna Charlie, negative, we're going to have to ditch you.
Roger. Sydney Air Force is closed at the moment, so Echidna Charlie has crashed in the bay.
Echidna
Charlie has crashed in the bay.
Just get everybody out.
This is XTP Media.
There were a couple of quick, sharp bangs and a slight divergence to the left. There was no massive swing or anything like that, just a slight divergence to the left. The co-pilot, who was the pilot flying, he called engine failure, left engine.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. For takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to this extra episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. With a flying career that spanned over 10,000 hours, the book From Hero to Zero covers the successful ditching of DC-3 Victor Hotel Echo Delta Charlie in Botany Bay on April the 24th, 1994. Captain Rod Lavelle was the pilot in command on that day, but having saved all on board, the aftermath of this ditching did not prove a happy experience. Let's hear about it. And let's talk to Rod. Welcome to Extended, Rod.
Thank you, Peter, and good morning.
Good morning. And for those who caught that little subtle point, it's very, very early in the morning where Rod is, and it's relatively late where I am. So thank you so much for making that effort, Rod.
An absolute pleasure.
Before we get to talk about the incident that the book really focuses on, let's talk about your flying career. How did you get into aviation? Because 10,000 hours, that's almost unheard of these days.
It is. I initially joined the Air Force, the Royal Australian Air Force here, and did my flying training on Mackie aircraft and Windjills, and then progressed to Mirage fighters, which is one of the most beautiful aeroplanes that was in the air. I don't know whether there's any more around now. And then after that, progressed to the magnificent P-3 Orion aircraft, anti-submarine warfare. And that the training on that aircraft was, unbeknown to me at the time, was going to be a huge factor a few years later when I had my accident.
Yeah, now we skipped very quickly through that potted history of your career. How did you get into aviation initially? Was it straight into the Air Force, or was there any aviation in the family?
No, there was no aviation background at all in the family. And when I joined the Air Force, I actually joined as a instrument mechanic. And through going up through the system of instrument mechanic, instrument fitter, then I got the qualifications, the educational qualifications to apply for pilot's course. I always wanted to be a pilot in the Air Force, as most young fellows did. But at the time going through school, I didn't have the educational qualifications. And that's one of the beauties of the services, which I've noticed. The service will help you and assist you get further qualifications. And it's a magnificent what would you say, a family to be in.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you talked about the Mirage there. Obviously, that was well into your Air Force career. But I was flicking through some notes, and I picked out a few incidents that you had on the Mirage. A flame out sticks in the mind.
Yeah, so I'd done a Mark II run off the shore off of Sydney up to Williamtown, and as I was slowing down, pulling up to 50,000 feet, the engine flamed out, and everything went very quiet quickly.
Yeah.
And again, thanks to very good training, I carried out all the procedures and pointed the nose down. And for those people who don't know, and it's a common phrase, that the Mirage has the gliding properties of a brick, and I can vouch for that. It just goes straight down, and you've got to be below 25,000 feet to before you attempt to relight because of the air density, etc. And when I got down to 25,000 feet, I went through the procedures, and thankfully the engine relit, and I landed successfully at Williamtown. What I had decided was the rate of descent is absolutely incredible, and I decided that if the engine didn't relight, I was going to bang out or eject, as they say.
Yeah.
But thankfully it did.
You didn't ever eject, did you, in your career? No, you didn't.
No.
But you were lucky enough to participate in some pretty impressive training, and you've also been a display pilot as well. You were a display pilot on the Orion, weren't you?
Correct. The Orion, as I said, Lockheed Orion, was a beautiful aeroplane, and I was fortunate enough to represent Australia in the Fincastle competition at the time. I think the year was 77 or 76 or something, and in fact that was the Commonwealth Air Forces, in which the RAF, the RCAF, and also the Royal New Zealand Air Force, we have a fly-off in the anti-submarine sector. So I was very pleased and proud to represent Australia in that fly-off. And then towards the end of my career, yes, I was a display pilot for the Orion. And as I said, magnificent aeroplane, power to boot, and thoroughly loved it.
Yeah, I recently saw a Canadian one, actually, an air day I was at, and I did, in fact, put my eight-year-old daughter in front of it and get a picture so that I can have that sat on my desk for more than one reason. But, yeah, not too many of them around now. But you then went on to become what was classed a Category B Marine Captain on the Orion 3B.
Yeah, a Category B maritime captain, sorry to correct you. Yeah, maritime captain, which meant you go up in the categories, and I think from looking at the logbook, it meant an above average Orion pilot, which, again, I was very proud to achieve that.
And when you left the Air Force, was the Orion the last aircraft you flew there?
It was. Okay. It was. And then I went to civil flying and flew the Armstrong Whitworth Argosy, which, again, your RAF had.
Yeah. I haven't seen one of those for a long time, Rod.
And do you remember what they were called? I'll let the listeners Google as to what they were called. But anyway.
I don't, actually. I can remember the very bulbous shape of them with the skinny, skinny protruding fin.
Well, exactly, and I will fill you in then. The bulbous nose, your RAF ones, had a beautiful little radome in the front of that, which looked like a woman's breast, and as such, when they were going through the air, they were called the whistling tit.
right. Okay. Just before we leave the Air Force, one of the questions I did want to ask you is it's a very unusual move from the Mirage to the Orion.
It was, and I'll be very honest here, it was probably my personality. A little bit of the Mirage is a fighter environment, obviously,
yeah,
and it's a little bit like the Top Gun movies in which
lots of
you
egos.
Say, well, I'm – exactly. You've said it in one. Right. And I'm afraid my personality didn't – I love the Mirage and I think I flew it well, but my time in the bar wasn't up to expected.
Right. But you also, and it's very relevant, you were very lucky to participate in some training in the Air Force that helped you later. You know, the ejection training, but a lot of other things, including, pressure chamber training and stuff like that. All of those things all came home to help you during the incident, didn't they?
They did. In fact, you've just reminded me that we used to do numerous practice ditchings in the Orion because I guess 90% of our flying was over water, way out to sea, etc., and anything could happen that necessitated a ditching. So we used to practice that quite a lot so that, again, fast forwarding to 1994, when it happened, it was just like a second nature to me. I didn't really have to think about it at all. And it probably sounds funny and hopefully not cocky saying that, but training is paramount in anything that you do, training along with experience. And so, yes, and I'm one of the things that I put in my book, Peter, is I'm very, what would you say, critical of the fact that manufacturers, airline manufacturers and regulators and airlines do not cover ditching for modern-day airlines and aeroplanes. And we hop on board a modern airliner and we have a host, a flight attendant, I think we'd call them these days, who show us how to put a life jacket on, where they're stowed and all these sort of things. But the pilots are not taught how to ditch an aeroplane. And believe you me, ditching an aeroplane is entirely different from dead sticking an aeroplane.
Yeah.
It really is. And yet nobody wants to acknowledge it. The authorities don't want to acknowledge it. And yet if we successfully ditched a big aeroplane, it would make a lot of difference in the outcome. And yeah. I think it should be. And as I said, I put that in the book very strongly.
Yeah, we're starting to pick elements of the book up now. I think the whole focus is not only the incident that, you know, with VHEDC, but some of the shortcomings in the whole sector come out. But let's come back to that. I just want to crack on and talk about your civilian career, because not only were you a captain of the Orion when you left, but you were also endorsed as a captain on the 747, the DC-9, the DC-3, the Learjet, Citation, King Air. I could go on and on and on. Tell us a little bit about your civilian career.
Very exciting. Thoroughly enjoyed it. It was a little bit different, obviously, to the Air Force career, but I enjoyed a lot of charter work. We used to do celebrity and VIP corporate charter work in the Learjets and Citations. We also used to do a lot of organ donor transplants, medivacs we call them. We also did a couple of those on the Orion as well, because the Orion was a pressurized aeroplane and ideally suited for long-range interstate medical evacuations.
Right,
so in the corporate... Sorry?
No, I didn't know that. I didn't know that the Orion was used in that role.
It was, because we could – one instance we did, we had to go to Townsville, which is in Queensland, and pick up a diver who was suffering from the bends.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting thing is, as your listeners would know about the bends, so the Orion, we could fly back to Sydney to give him medical assistance, but we could have a ground level – pressurization in the aircraft. So again, it was ideally suited, because in the bends, as you know, you don't want any altitude at all to affect some the person enormously with the air.
So tell us about the big heavies, the DC-9 and the 747. Who did you fly with? What were they like to operate?
The DC-9 was a beautiful airplane. It was If you talk to airline people, it was like the sports car of that era. You could literally do anything with it. you really could. And air traffic in Melbourne, when I used to fly for IPAC with the DC-9, was they knew our capabilities, and we would quite often go from, say, number four in the landing sequence, and they'd push us up to number one because they knew the versatility of the DC-9. We could come through the locator beacon at 300 knots and still land. It was beautiful of it. And regarding the 747, what happened with that? I got an endorsement on the 747 through Qantas when I went to Qantas as a simulator instructor, and we did obviously training and things like that. So I haven't actually flown a 747, but I'm endorsed to fly a 747. So that was very interesting. And of course, what happened was that was in 1989, and I don't know whether your listeners are aware, but we had a big. It wasn't a strike. They said it was an industrial dispute here in Australia with the domestic pilots, and it lasted for about 6 to 8 months, and it had huge ramifications throughout the tourism industry. Everybody was affected by it. So, as I said, getting back to 89, when I was employed by Qantas as a simulator instructor, I finished the course. And about 2 months after that, I got the "Don't Come Monday" letter because the traffic and the passengers had gone down enormously, and obviously international passengers didn't want to come to Australia because they couldn't travel around internally. So, yeah. So it affected us enormously. It's probably one of the worst periods we've had in Australian history for tourism and areas such as.
Okay, and you know there are a number of other aircraft that you've flown as well. You've got your formation endorsements and some aerobatics as well. I think in the whole, you've pretty much seen most elements of the sector, haven't you? From the big heavy jets right down to the to helicopters and such like.
Correct. In fact, I did own for probably about, I can't think now, 15 years, 20 years, a beautiful tiger moth.
Wow.
And I loved it, absolutely loved it. And also a Beechcraft 18, which, again, is like a mini DC-3. It's a beautiful aeroplane. It was about an 8-seater, twin-engine radials. So I'm one of these guys that's what would you say? You fly for a living, and then people say, "Well, what do you do on the weekend?" Oh, I fly aeroplanes.
Very
the tiger moth was, what I like to think of, Peter, sorry to interrupt you, was I like to think of myself as an aviator, as in the old style. Yes, I still have my leather helmet here and goggles and flying boots and flying jacket just in case I get caught out again. But it's a different era to being an aviator, I think, is you walk out to the aeroplane and you're looking all around you. You're looking for the cues that you can see, like the wind, the clouds, all these things before you even get to the aeroplane. And you start to bond with the aeroplane. And if I can tell you a funny story, my dear old dad, and you're going to laugh at this, my dear old dad was born in 1886. So he was quite old when he had me, and we grew up on a farm here, and Dad had draft horses to do all the ploughing and farming, et cetera. And then in 1948, he bought a tractor, and he said to me, "Son, you can't talk to machinery. Give me a horse any day. You can't talk to machinery." Now, I'm one of these people that it's probably the only time I've disagreed with dear old Dad, because I think you can. I think you can get in sync with machinery, particularly aeroplanes and trucks and things like that, and you can feel what they want to do. They do tell you things, and I'm probably going to be scoffed at by a lot of people, but I believe that you can get to that bond with machinery, and it will tell you. Aeroplanes will tell you if something's going wrong long before an instrument will. And so that's part of my background, I guess, is I'm proud of the fact that you can listen to machinery, and it will tell you if you've got a fine ear and a fine feel on the controls.
Well, just talking about the Tiger Moth there, I've been lucky enough to have just a pleasure flight and hand fly for 15, 20 minutes. And I'm not a qualified pilot. I was a failed private pilot. But I have to say, I found that machine extremely difficult to fly. You know, there weren't many dials, controls, levers, or anything like that, and I found her quite a handful. And it was, you had to feel the aeroplane, not read the instruments and take it from there, which was a very unusual feeling, given that I'd been taught to, you know, to do my T's and P's and all that sort of thing. I do get what you're saying.
But also too, Peter, you said it was a difficult aeroplane. That's the whole idea of a training aeroplane. You don't want a training aeroplane that's a piece of pie to fly. Yeah. You want something that's a little bit tricky so that you hone your skills for being straight and level and going into turns and using the rudder. You want an aeroplane that you have to work at, I guess. But yeah, it's, the Tiger's a beautiful aeroplane, hand swinging the prop. And in fact, in those days, with mine, there was no electrics, there was no brakes, there was a piece of metal at the back as a tail skid, and it did hone your skills, and I think makes people better pilots if they've got a tail dragger endorsement.
Okay, well, let's talk about the DC-3 then, and let's get on to the story we're here to tell. How did you get involved with the DC-3? It sort of sits outside some of those other aircraft types.
It does, and it's a fairly long story, and I'll try and keep it as short as I can. IPAC, when they got their airline license here in Australia, which was the late 70s, I think 76, we had a two-airline policy then. It was ANSET and TAA. And if you wanted to go into competition against those two airlines, then it was very, very hard. IPAC originally got their license to fly from Essendon, which is Melbourne, down to Tasmania, and the night freight. Then they wanted to branch interstate, and so you have to gain additional licenses, air operator certificates to work interstate. Now, the government, because of the two-airline policy, which were operating jets and DC-9s, Boeing 727s, et cetera, the government said, well, you can only do it in a DC-3. So Gordon Barton, who was the chairman and founder of IPAC, said, well, blow you, we'll do it in a DC-3 then. So they got a DC-3. And we used to go from Essendon to Sydney every night in a DC-3 just to show the government that we'd do it. So that's how they did it. They complied. And, so I was trained on a DC-3 by a beautiful old guy who's still alive up at Noosa, which is north of Queensland. And he had something like 14,000 hours in DC-3s alone. Wow. So he trained me in the DC-3. So absolutely superb.
Okay. So let's talk about that fateful day. Do you want to talk us through, I think maybe from the day before, because just reading some of the notes about the incident, and, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there on the internet, and some of it's conflicting. So just talk us through the sort of build up, because my reading of the various bits that I've put together is that it was meticulously planned, almost like you knew something was going to happen.
Well, no. Well, I guess, as I say in my book, I think a good pilot is a pessimist, not an optimist, and that's how we prepare for a lot of things. So we were doing significantly long overwater flights from Sydney to Lord Howe Island, then on to Norfolk Island, and as such, most of the crew had not been in that environment before. So the week before, I got my supernumerary pilot to come around, and we did hours and hours of flight planning. So I showed him to give him the experience, because he had not been part of a crew that had done any overseas flying before over water.
Okay.
So we did hours and hours of that. the day before, our flight attendant, she likewise had not done any overwater experience. So we probably spent 3 or 4 hours on what's called the Eastern Park at Sydney Airport, beautiful grassy area of the aeroplane. And we went over like ditching procedures, survival, what she would do, how she'd get people out of the aeroplane. Because you've got to realise that in a lot of these emergency scenarios that it's not highly probable that all the crew, be it the cabin crew or the flight crew, will survive. So as such, you have to, like we may have been killed, the flight crew may have been killed if we impacted the water too hard, etc. So it would be up to the flight attendant to get everybody out, launch the life rafts, do everything like that. So we spent hours and hours. And it's something, I guess, that I've put in all through aviation. It's not the minimum required. In fact, one time with one of our examiners of airmen here in Sydney years ago, and I'm probably going back almost 30 years now, she was actually a female examiner, a lovely girl, and I put something in the ops manual which, what would you say, alluded to the fact that our standards were higher than the Civil Aviation Authority. And she took me to task over that. And I said to her, I said, but you put down the minimum standards to be achieved. I said, we aim and achieve a lot more higher standards than you've put down. And she took offence at that. But anyway, it's something I believe in. It's like anything, Peter, as you would know. The more you put into things, the more you get out of it. Yeah. You can't just go through. And I've known pilots, I'll be honest now, I've known pilots that as long as they fly from A to B and arrive at B safely, they're the happiest people in the world. But my whole ethics on aviation, and I used to, we'd come home from a simulator ride. And I'm saying this as the truth, we would, on a simulator ride, as soon as I got home, I'd ring up a mate who was a Czech captain on the same aeroplane, and we'd discuss what I'd done and things like that to go to the nth degree. Most people get out of a simulator and they just go and have a beer or a coffee or something like that. Well, I take it a little bit further. Any flight that I did throughout my whole career, on my drive home, I would dissect it and think, well, perhaps I could have done this, perhaps I should have extended another quarter of a mile downwind, perhaps I should have done this or perhaps I should have done that. So, and I believe, as I said before, the more you put into it, the more you get out of it.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
You said you were flying to Norfolk Island?
Correct.
And that's about 400, 450 miles, something like that, off the coast.
Yeah.
And what was the purpose of the flight?
It was to go out. We were planning to leave on the 24th of April, excuse me, to go take the Scots College Band to Norfolk Island for Anzac Day service. As you know, Anzac Day here is highly commemorated. So we were taking the band out there and they were going to perform for the Anzac Day service.
Was the choice of aircraft part of that? I just thought of that, really.
I don't know, Peter. I guess the companies that go around, TNT Air Charter, would have gone to numerous companies to get a quote, I'd say. And I never got involved in any of that part of the organisation whatsoever. It's not my forte. No. I just fly aeroplanes. So.
Yeah. So the day before, the prep and the training and the awareness was done. Talk us through the build-up to the flight then.
Well, as I said, that was done. We probably spent, I think, over 3 hours, 3 to 4 hours the previous day, which was a Saturday. You go home and try and get some sleep the night before, and obviously do. And the Sunday morning, I think we left home about 7 o'clock in the morning to go to the airport. And while I was there, got to the airport, and the co-pilot had already started duties, as in pre-flighting. The airplane was refueled to the required amount, because what you have to do is carry enough fuel so that if you have a problem, say midway, just for argument's sake, midway between the islands, you've got enough fuel to divert either forward or back, come back.
Yeah.
And single engine, you burn more fuel than you do because you're going slower and lower than you do on two engines. So you've got to carry enough fuel to go single engine in your worst case scenario.
Was it fair to say, Rod, that the aircraft was fully laden?
No, it wasn't fully loaded at all.
Okay.
We only had, I think, 3 out of the 4 fuel tanks contained fuel. And when I did the weight and balance on the information I was given, we were, I think it was 180 kilograms or something like that under the maximum takeoff weight. So I was very happy with that.
Okay. And in terms of the startup, the engine tests, the run-ups, all went okay?
Yes, the co-pilot, who was also the part owner of the aeroplane, he did the engine run-ups. Again, that's normal procedure. I don't have to do them as captain. I just have to make sure they've been done. So he actually did them, and there were no abnormality at all or abnormal indications. And then we taxied from this eastern park, the grassed area, across to the terminal and load the passengers.
Okay, and you in your notes, I see mention of a supernumerary pilot. What?
Correct. That was a friend of mine that I've known. Well, he's a pilot qualified on type, and he was qualified on type, but he was not part of the operating crew. So he sat in the jump seat between the captain and the co-pilot to gain experience. And I think he gained more experience than he was expecting that day.
Okay. All's well. The aircraft, you weren't a pilot flying. You were pilot in command, but not pilot flying, as I understand it.
Correct. Okay. We go leg about as in normal airline procedures, and that way that gives the co-pilot more experience. He can't just sit there and do nothing, because his whole job or his whole job description is to back me up and assist me and also take over if anything happens to the captain. As I wouldn't say it's common, but it's not uncommon for a captain to cease to function at the critical time.
Right, okay. And all proceeded well, taxi, takeoff, and by all accounts a reasonable departure from terra firma?
It was. Everything appeared normal. We took off on runway 16. It was only 2 runways at Sydney at the time. The new one wasn't completed, so it was runway 16. Took off and at about 200 feet. Previous to this, I had selected the gear up, and again with a DC-3, you can't tell. One gear will often come up before another, so you don't know whether the gear's up or not, really. So or in the process, and about 200 feet, there were a couple of quick, sharp bangs and a slight divergent to the left. There was no massive swing or anything like that; just a slight, slight divergence to the left, and the co-pilot, who was the pilot flying, he called engine failure, left engine. And through the procedures, I confirmed that. You go through what's called the phase one procedures, which are memory items. And my memory is fading a bit now. But don't worry.
I think you feathered the propeller and got the emergency checklist out.
Correct. You do the first phase one items from memory. They were completed on confirmation. You don't do anything on your own. Like, for instance, you say left throttle, you put your finger on the left throttle, And the co-pilot says left throttle confirmed, left throttle closed. Left propeller feather button, you put your finger on the feather button, and the rider, the pilot flying confirms it. So it's everything is done deliberate, not in a hurried fashion at all, because you don't want to shut down the wrong engine. So, yeah, we did that. And then after the phase one items are done, then you call for the emergency checklist and go through them all again to, according to the checklist. So that was completed. And at this stage, I looked out, the propeller had stopped. But again, you don't have the time to ascertain whether it's in the 88 degree fully feathered position or 65 degree. You just have a quick glance to make sure it stopped.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. And at that stage, the co-pilot was still flying, and he was flying it very well. And I anticipated, if you listen to the voice recording, I anticipated literally coming around to the left to land on the east-west runway. And there was no panic, no hurry, nothing, because that was what we were trained to do. The aeroplane was expected to fly away, climb away on one engine. And I had briefed that we'd come around for a left circuit. So to my amazement, after a couple of seconds, the aircraft performance was just going nowhere. I'll be very honest. It felt like a drag chute had been popped out of the back of an aeroplane. You know how you like the Mirages and things like that, and the big jets have a parachute drag chute come out. That's what it felt like. We weren't going up, and in fact we were slowing down noticeably. It wasn't a gradual. It was very noticeable. So at that stage, I took over from the co-pilot. And with the indications, and I stress the indications, of full power on the right-hand engine, we were going nowhere fast but down. So, excuse me. So the options were put the gear down and land straight ahead on the runway, because I was still over the runway I'd taken off on. I didn't consider that an option because as I said, with the landing gear on the DC-3, you don't know whether one's up, one's down, and now we were down to one hydraulic pump, not two.
Yeah.
So time would have been doubled. The runway has rocks at the end, so I thought, well, if I can't get the gear down, we'll slide off the end and the rocks will rip open the fuel tanks and we'll all be fricasseed, as I say, which is not nice. The other option that I had was to possibly try and manoeuvre to land on the new runway, which was under construction, but there was machinery, there was mounds of dirt and sand and everything, so I couldn't negotiate that. And the other thing that was going through my mind, I don't know whether you read this, Peter, or not, but very sadly in 1980, a Super King Air had a similar situation. He took off from Sydney, and he had an engine failure. He tried to return and very sadly crashed into the seawall at Sydney and actually killed all on board, and including a one-week-old baby. Now, that was very powerful in the back of my mind, the thought process, excuse me, of that wasn't going to happen to my passengers. That was an incredible, overpowering thought. So, again, the other option, and getting back to what we said before, it was a ditching because of my training. And it, as soon as I decided on that, or should I say, eliminated the other two, then to carry out the ditching off between the two runways, that was easy. You just control the aeroplane, make sure you don't get below VMCA, which is minimum control speed in the air, because if I had, it would have rolled over on its back and destroyed everybody on board in the aeroplane. And I just manoeuvred around one boat and calculated a ditching speed and put it down.
And, now, Rod, sorry, just to clarify a point about the landing gear, was it down, was it up? Did that influence your decision in any way?
Well, it did. You want it up for ditching, obviously, and it was selected up after the engine failure. It had not been selected down, so I was hoping it was tucked up. But, as I said, there was no way of being assured, and again to the listeners, I reiterate that we've talked now, Peter, for a couple of minutes or something like that.
Yeah.
The time from the engine failure to in the water was 46 seconds. Now, that's not a lot of time to recognise what the situation you're in, assess your options, and then carry them out. It's not a long time. And my good friend Sully, he had 208 seconds from his engine failure to in the water. So
that wasn't lost on me, I must say. Certainly when I read about it, 46 seconds is over in a flash.
Hi, Mick Oakey here, Managing Editor of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. The guys at Extended have once again kindly given me a few minutes to talk about our latest edition, TAH-28, officially published on July the 15th. The new issues arrived from the printers a few days ago, and I immediately posted a picture on our Facebook page. The issue has a particularly compelling cover photograph, a dynamic head-on view by Peter Lewis of a Swiss Dassault Mirage 3RS Amir, the photo recce variant, snaking through a vertiginous mountain valley. The snow-speckled background is nicely blurred, and the aircraft is pin-sharp, the sense of high-speed motion enhanced by the snaking wingtip vortices and the hot shimmer of the jet efflux. Oh, it's a delight. The Facebook post attracted comments ranging from, "That's a bit of a photo, is that?" to, "Oh, baby," with 3 exclamation marks. And it's not just Peter Lewis's flying photographs that make our cover story special. The Mirages were housed in a cavernous hangar tunnel carved into a mountainside, where a roof-mounted hoist system was used to pick them up from their parking bays, carry them over the top of their stablemates, and deposit them at the hangar mouth. We had to get special permission to include a very rare photo of that. Anyone excited by our cover story is likely to be equally excited by the rest of the issue. We explore the aeromedical aspects of piloting the Luftwaffe's Bachem-Natter rocket interceptor, not an article for the squeamish, Howard Hughes's special fondness for the Lockheed Constellation, World War II attempts to turn the Douglas DC-4E airliner and the C-54 transport into bombers, RAF heavy guns, and the political genesis of the Airbus programme, which nearly fell victim to what author Professor Keith Hayward calls a proto-Brexit. Oh, I said the B word again. That's another 50p in the tin. Finally, we publish a bizarre sequence of photographs showing a fairy barracuda being pushed over a cliff on the Welsh coast sometime in the mid-1940s to smash onto the rocks below. It's like the full-size equivalent of a schoolboy setting fire to an Airfix model. Why and exactly where did it happen? We investigate. Right, time's up. Remember, our journal is not on sale in newsagents, but you can order it online via our website, theaviationhistorian.com. Until next time, then, this is Mick Oakey talking to Extended.
Can I ask you what went through your mind as the aircraft touched the water?
As it touched the water,
yeah.
The biggest thing was the speed. I'd got the speed right back to what I calculated as ditching speed, so the old kinetic energy and impact forces would be less. I was amazed, and I you've just prompted my memory. I was amazed at the lower perspective, because when you land a DC-3, your eye level is, I think from memory, 15 feet above the tarmac.
Yeah,
and here we were now, probably only 5 or 6 foot above the water. And I do remember thinking, gee, is this perspective's a bit low.
yeah. Looking back, I suppose you can feel that. Of course, it was over in seconds. Now, the aircraft, due to the landing that you made, did not break up, did it?
No. The only thing that happened was it swung around to the right. Now, just remember the aircraft configuration. We've got the right engine going, so the propeller's spinning. The left engine is feathered, so there's no drag. So when we touched down, the aircraft swung abruptly, not violently, but abruptly around to the right about 90 degrees due to the spinning propeller. And, in fact, the right-hand engine was ripped from the airframe, again, due to the drag hitting the water.
Yeah, okay.
And that was really about the only severe damage to the airframe. The good old EC3 stayed intact and was magnificent in what she was designed to do. When we came to a halt, my head was thrown forward and I hit the windscreen and as you know, in those aeroplanes, there's nuts and bolts and knobs everywhere. Yeah, so yeah. That drew a little bit of blood, which wasn't too bad. I think I was knocked out for probably a second or two. I do remember sort of like coming to. The fire bell was going, the landing gear horn was going, and then we turned off the battery master and I think the water shorted out some other things, connections, so that everything went quiet. And with that, I said to Andrew, the supernumerary, I said, just get everybody out. So he went down the back to assist with the evacuation. The co-pilot went over the escape hatch, overhead cockpit escape hatch, and went down walked down the top of the fuselage onto the starboard tailplane and then into a boat. So we he never even got
classy.
Wet.
Classy. And everybody, and there were, was it 26 people on board POB?
We had 21 passengers and four crew.
Four crew, 25, so, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. So, okay. But the other interesting thing, Peter, and I'll never forget it, when I went to look around, because from the cockpit you can see a little bit down the back, I expect to see carnage. I really did. I thought there'd be limbs and bits of body everywhere. And these kids were standing up, a few were laughing and putting their life jackets on. Well, that's the greatest sense of relief I've ever had in my life. Yeah. It was amazing.
I can't imagine. I can't imagine.
It was fantastic. And then to skip to when we're out of the aeroplane.
And you were the last out, weren't you?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Andrew and I, and I was physically the last out, but we went through the aeroplane to make sure there was nobody left on board, and which is it's part of the captain's duties. You know, there's no do I or don't I. You just do it as part of your job to look after your passengers. And again, I was pleased with the outcome because the only physical injury was to the flight attendant who broke her wrist in the accident. So that. That was an immense relief to hear that.
Okay, and people came to rescue boats, small boats, and interestingly enough, there's some photos as well of the aircraft sitting in the water before it sank.
Yes. Now another interesting story, which I think is quite funny, the supernumerary pilot Andrew and I were in a boat. And he rang his wife. At that time, one of the fishermen had a mobile phone, so he rang his wife at 9:30 in the morning and said something like, just to let you know, everything's okay. We're in the water in Botany Bay, but everything's okay. And he had a bit of a laugh with his wife, you see, and he got off the phone and I said, what was that about? And he said, Rod, you wouldn't believe this, but she had a premonition and she begged and begged me not to go. She said she knew it was happening and, you know, I'm skeptical about a lot of these things, but she was adamant, he was adamant, she begged him not to go. So I immediately got on the phone to her and I said, well, next time, don't tell him, tell me.
very good. Okay, so everyone was rescued and... I can only say from everything I've seen and read, you know, your flying skills saved their lives.
Let's say my training and Air Force training and civilian training, all that culminated to come together at the time. And my wife at the time, I remember saying, that when I was put in this position, I said, my brain was working faster than the computer was. she said, that's not possible, Rod. But it's funny how quickly you assess a situation and then you've just got to decide. There's no, will I do that or won't I? You just don't have the time. You've just got to go with all your training and select what, and I think the proof's in the pudding there of what happened. So,
yeah.
And I'll tell you, Peter, given the same instances, same circumstances, I would do exactly the same today. I have no regrets about anything that I did. But having said that, let me tell you, and it's coming out now in a few accident reports, that after you have a major accident, the self-doubt that comes in is overwhelming. Mm. Like the aircraft crashed, it's supposed to keep going and flying on one engine. So you what did I do wrong? What did I miss? What did I do? And it does. The self-doubt for the next few days or weeks, and a lot of pilots are saying this now, was devastating. And the other thing too, if I can talk about the personal side, at that time after the accident, I was not part of a union. The company was basically two pilots. And so you don't get a lot of support that you would get. Oh, yes, yeah. And so you really feel alone. And then, if I can say it, you know, in the day or two afterwards, and it keeps going for years, the vultures start to gather, as in the authority and the accident investigators, because they want an answer. And they just come for the – but anyway, you can ask me about that in a minute if you want.
Well, no, let's talk about it because obviously, within days of the incident, you were notified that your license had been suspended.
No, in fact, if I can correct you, Peter, it wasn't within days. It was 9 weeks after.
Now, the
interesting thing is, why 9 weeks? They said in my license suspension, they said I may have been a danger to the safety of air navigation, and I said to them, but if I was a danger to passengers and things like that, why didn't you suspend my license that day or the day after? Why'd you wait 9 weeks? Now, what happened was they said to me they were floundering and they wanted answers. There had been another fatal accident a few months before which killed a lot of people. There was another fatal accident just afterwards. And so the CAA at the time was in turmoil as to what were causing these aeroplane accidents.
Yeah.
And they couldn't really find anything, so they came up with all these ideas of what I may or may not have done wrong. But the interesting thing was they said to me that you've got to go to counselling. And I said, but if I go to your counselling, I'm admitting I've done something wrong. And I said, I haven't done anything wrong at all. Yeah. And so I'm not coming to your counselling. And they, in fact, and I've got all this documented, they said to me over the phone, if you don't go to counselling, if you don't attend counselling, we'll suspend your licence. Now, if that's not intimidation and bullying, I don't know what is by government authority. I'm just blown away. So I said, well, I'm not attending your counselling. So on a Friday afternoon, 9 weeks after the accident, they send a fax to my home suspending my licence.
They sent a fax to your home.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah. Well, it doesn't get any better, does it? And, I mean, there is an element of hindsight, of course there is, but in terms of the reports that were then produced to reflect what they perceived to be the cause of the accident, you've vehemently opposed.
They were all trumped up charges. Their smokescreen, this alleged overweight, all this sort of, and it is rubbish that they trumped up. Now, with that, Oh, now the interesting thing is if you or your readers get on now on the internet, they can download the official BASI report on the accident. And on page whatever it is, it said the right-hand engine, which was the one supposed to keep us up in the air, had no pre-existing abnormalities, right? So as their report says, it was fine and good.
Yeah.
I got documents out of BASI, the Bureau of Air Safety Investigation, about 3 years later that said that when they stripped the right-hand engine, 11 out of the 28 spark plugs were unserviceable, right? 11 out of the 28. Now, I on the facts that I know now, instead of that engine producing 1,200 horsepower, I think it was producing between 750 and 800 horsepower. There's no way in the world that was going to keep us in the air.
Yeah.
And they won't come back. They won't. I've got no comeback. I don't have the finances to fight the government. So this is the reason that I'm putting it all in the book, so that the average person can read the facts rather than the smoke screen that the government's put out.
So that refers to, quote unquote, the maintenance error that they talk about, an engine overhaul or maintenance error, which you've now shown to be an issue. Why didn't they take that up with what was the maintenance organisation that undertook the servicing of that aircraft?
I really can't comment, Peter, on that. That's I totally agree. That's my question. And my biggest question is, why did the CIA allow this aeroplane to fly in the first place when they knew there was so much wrong with it?
How did they know, Rod? Sorry, I'm sorry to be.
Oh well, they went through a lot of the service records, the maintenance logbooks, etc., and they found a lot of things that were inconsistent with what the aeroplane had. But for obvious reasons, I don't want to comment publicly on my thoughts. But they are what you question are my questions too. Why did the CIA allow this aeroplane to fly?
Okay,
and. They're the reason that it failed to proceed in the air. It's not my reason.
But when you when you were presented with the aircraft, you signed for it. What did you sign for, or what information were you given to suggest the aircraft was in a fit state to fly?
Well, you're given a what's called a maintenance release over here, and that is signed off by the engineer, who says basically that the aeroplane is fit to fly and safe to fly. And I don't, by the rules and regulations and time and practicality, I don't have the time to go in and look at the engine logbooks and go through. You have to take what's given to you in a signed certificate on face value. You really do. And it's like, as I said, the system alleges that I was overweight and actually said that I should have weighed each passenger. Now, under the law, no, I don't have to. The authority gives me standard weights and I'm legally allowed to use those, which I did.
Isn't that custom and practice, though? And I know that's maybe not the best thing to run an airline on, but isn't it custom and practice to use standard weights for calculating aircraft loads?
It is across the board. And as I said to them, well, why don't you make every 747 captain weigh every passenger and check them when they go on board? Oh, no, that's we don't have to do that. There's already standard weights. And I said, well, you can't have it both ways.
Yeah.
And if I'm illegally allowed to use standard weights, you can't crucify me for that. You can't criticise my use of that.
So, I'm misunderstanding why the aircraft was overweight, because we talked earlier and you were quite adamant that it wasn't.
Correct. Now, I witnessed the aircraft in what was now called the old East-West Hangar, which has been pulled down at Sydney Airport, and I witnessed BASI weighing the bags. Now, remember, these bags had been underwater for 2 or 3 days. They were dripping wet. They would put them on an old set of analog scales and weigh them. And I said, well, you can't do that. You know, most people had jumpers and things like that. I said, you can't weigh that. And the Barzi operator said to me, oh, we just factor it. Now, again, you can't do that. They did all these things. And the other thing which is very interesting is an aircraft is weighed, right, every 3 years. I don't know what it is over there, but every 3 years it was here. Now, that is a datum to go from. When it was weighed, I think it was in 92, from memory, that reweigh was illegal. And yet that doesn't get mentioned anywhere. And yet it was illegal. Everything about the reweigh was illegal. So the datum for being overweight is in contention all the time.
Okay.
They just had to have excuses that they think the public would accept. And again, if you look at any website, in fact, Aviation Safety Network, I checked earlier on this morning, and again, their report, which they got from the Barzi report, says the same thing. It was overweight. Mm. Nowhere, Peter, does it mention about these engines that were down on power. And I maintain that when we lost the left engine, I think we lost the better of the two engines that were producing power.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Rod, did they discover why the left engine failed?
Yes, that did. This is unbelievable. I'll put it as simply as I can. With the engines being piston engines and you've got push rods and rocker arms. Now, rocker arm has a washer or supposed to have a washer each side of it when it goes on the pinion. Now, one of those washers was actually found lodged under the intake valve of a certain cylinder. I can't think which one it was now. So how it came out from the pinion that was holding it and went down and lodged under the intake valve, as I say, even Houdini couldn't have made it do that. But anyway, it lodged there. So what happened was that intake valve for that cylinder could never close.
No.
It obviously lodged there on this particular point on takeoff. And as such, when that cylinder fired, the flame front went all the way through the induction system so that every cylinder, when it was sucking in what should have been a fuel-air mixture, was sucking in already burnt air. So, and I told the investigators it just lost power immediately. So, now that all came up. That is in the Barzi report, but again, it was taken no further.
Right, okay. I want to come back to the handling issue, but the last point that I want to highlight here is they said there was non-adherence to operating procedures.
But as I say, Peter, you know, these are people who sit in an office, air-conditioned, having coffee and saying, well, what do you think he did? What do you think? How come he ended up in this position? They weren't there. I gave them a full report, factual, on what happened, and they weren't there. So they've got to come up with some other idea as to why it wouldn't fly. So they come up with non-adherence to procedures. Now, the interesting thing is one of the reasons, they gave me four reasons why they suspended my license, and one of them was that I hadn't adhered to a section of the operations manual. And I didn't adhere to it, and I'll tell you why, because that page was removed in December of 93. So the CAA had not even amended their copy of the operations manual, and they're quoting things that I should have done which weren't in the operations manual.
Right. Okay. I get that one. Now, a slightly more tenuous and contentious issue is the term the inability of the handling pilot to obtain a symmetric performance and the lack of the skill of the handling pilot. From everything you've told me, was there anything else he could have done if he'd have done anything wrong?
No, he did everything correct, Peter. And again, to put this in perspective, I carried out a flight check on the co-pilot in January of 94, in which I assessed him as above average as handling. Another DC-3 training captain assessed him, I think it was the year before, as above average. And they're clutching at straws, and unfortunately they're soggy straws that just won't stand up.
Was his license suspended as well?
No, that's another interesting story. When Barzi investigated his license, they found out that he had been issued a license by the authority here in Australia on a non-valid American license. So in actual fact, technically and legally, he was unlicensed. But again, he showed me his license. I'm criticised, I think, in the Barzi report, that I should have checked his license. Well, I don't. If the authority issues a license, why do I have to check everything? They don't. And I go back again to a Qantas captain. He doesn't climb on board and say to his first officer, "Oh, show me your license. Where did you do your training? How much experience you got?" We take these things on face value, and we're allowed to. How much do you go back?
Okay.
So again, the authority has egg on their face over that issue as well.
Right. Okay. I mean, you don't have to answer this if you don't want to. But did the co-pilot continue flying, or as a result?
No, I don't know. Because of what I found out about the maintenance and other sectors of the organisation, I severed all ties with him. I think it was the day after,
okay.
As things were coming to light, which I wasn't happy with, sort of thing. So I didn't want to be associated with.
Okay, so tell me, Rod, this was all coming out from plus nine onwards. I was going to say years, but decades have passed. What's happened since?
Well, I'm just finding more and more information about the maintenance on the aeroplane, the turmoil in the CAA, and what I've done with the book, if that's what you're alluding to, is the fact that I can't take them to court. I don't have the money. I don't have the emotional, strength to spend months and months in court, because I know what they do. They just draw it out. That's all they do, to break people. So I don't do that. So the easiest thing for me is to write this book. And I'll say to you now, Peter, the book, everything in it happened. I'll stand by that. Everything happened. I may have got perhaps times or dates wrong, but every event in the book happened. So, and I'm discovering more and more reasons why the aeroplane wasn't flying, and it's so wrong. I've been crucified for 25 years. I've lost good income. I've lost a marriage over things which I wasn't part of. I was part of, but I didn't contribute to.
Yeah.
And this is my way of, I think, to coin a phrase for the 21st century, I think when my book is physically published at the end of October, it'll be a little bit of closure for me, because then anybody like yourself or anybody around the world can read the facts of it. Because as I said, if you read it now on the internet, it is lies.
No, it's not just, and I don't in any way mean to belittle this, but it's not just the incident, the report, and the suspension of your license. I believe even when you did regain your license and were seeking employment. Did I hear on a news item somewhere that somebody had rung the CAA for a reference and they declined it?
Excuse me. What happened was, it was always an ambition of mine to work for fly for the RFDS, the Royal Flying Doctor Service here.
Yeah.
So it was only about, I think, 10, 12 years ago, an advert came up and I thought, oh, yes, that would be very nice, I'll do that. So I applied for the position. They interviewed me. They put me on a refresher course for the King Air because I'd flown them before.
Yeah.
And I passed everything.
You had your license back at this time?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. What I did, in fact, jumping back to the license, I went to the States and notified the FAA. This is in mid-94, mid to late 94. I emailed them, told them exactly everything that had happened. Now, the interesting thing is with my license check in America, and I've got it in writing, they did a flight check on me, which I think was double the normal time in the air, and I think the oral was double the time. And they said that they could not fault my flying in a DC-3. So I did it in a DC-3, so I wanted everybody to know. So that was very nice that they – and then if I can tell you this, then the CAA back here, on the strength of my FAA license, gave me my license back here. And then they had – this just blows me away. They wrote me a letter saying, we're giving you back your license, but in no way does this endorse or approve the actions you took on the day of the ditching. What do they want? Yeah. What the hell do they want? I'm just blown away. Anyway, getting back to the King Air, RFDS. So I passed their interview, their simulator ride, their technical refresher, and they were about to hand me an offer of employment on a Friday afternoon. And they said, oh, just before we do this, we've got to check with New South Wales Health, who contracted the RFDS. So they contacted New South Wales Health, and the guy in there said, oh, no, you can't use Rod. He's got an adverse BASI report against him. So this is the repercussions down the road. Mm. Nobody would hire me after the accident because I was, and I admit I was, outspoken against the CAA.
Yeah.
I used to use words which I won't use on the air now. But I said, you know, how dare they take away my license? So if Joe Blow's Citation Jets wanted to hire me, they wanted to hire me, but they knew if they hired me, they would come under the microscope and they'd probably get ramp checks, maintenance checks, probably every second week. The pressure would be put on them enormously, yeah. And that's how it works here. So my opportunities for employment in the flying field after the accident were literally zero. I didn't have one job after it, but that nobody would hire me, and they couldn't.
And did you continue flying for leisure after that, Rod?
No. I've it's taken a bit of the wind out of my sails, I must admit. I wouldn't mind like a beautiful morning now, the sun's shining here now, Peter, but I wouldn't mind there's no wind, and I wouldn't mind, say, getting in a Tiger Moth now at this time of the morning, not talking to anybody, not putting in a flight plan, and just doing what I enjoyed, and that's aviating.
Yeah.
But, no, the passions has dwindled a hell of a lot, and I'm sorry to say that, because it was a huge passion of mine to fly for a living and fly for sport, and it was fantastic. But that's what they do. You know, how long can you go on like this? It's been 25 years now.
Yeah.
Which I feel really gutted. I was, and I'll be honest, after the accident when they took my license away and the BASI report came out, I was full of hatred. But that has diminished now. I guess you would say that I'm just upset that people can do this to somebody. And I didn't do anything wrong. I did not do a damn thing wrong. And that's what annoys me, that they can destroy lives, destroy careers, and they're not answerable to anybody, Peter. They're not answerable to anybody at all. Do you know somebody? I'll just tell you, somebody now. I've got my license back now. And somebody could come in here now from CASA and say, Rod, we require you to undertake an examination, and that examination will be done in Darwin on the 12th of February in the year 2025, and until you do, your license is suspended. Mm-hmm. And they have that right to do that right now, and that is frightening.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have to give a reason. They can just come in.
Let's wrap up there then, Rod. One question. The Goldfish Club. Tell me about the Goldfish Club. Sorry, one more thing on my list.
That's good. Obviously, when you have an accident like this, or all the time, I should say, through my whole flying career, I look at other accidents and their causes and what they did and what the pilots did. And that, again, goes into the huge database, even though you haven't been involved, but you've read about it. So anyway, a gentleman over your way by the name of Art Stacey, who ditched a Nimrod at Kinloss, I think it was in 96.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you're aware of that or not.
Yeah, I am.
And he did a marvellous thing. He knew the dire straits that the Nimrod was in, and it's my understanding he was only about 4 or 5 miles away from landing, and yet he still ditched it because he knew he had to save the crew.
Yeah.
He did a marvellous thing. So searching for the Goldfish Club is what Art was in, and that's how I've just become a member of the Goldfish Club, and very proud of it for people who've successfully ditched an aeroplane. So it's a nice thing to belong to.
I was going
to
say congratulations from that. Tell us then about the book, From Hero to Zero. It's called, self-published, I believe.
Yes, it is, because again, it's the best way I think that I can get my message across.
How can you get hold of it?
If they go to my website, which is fromherotozero.com.au.
Okay.
And that's there's a link there to purchase the book. So the book is obviously a little bit of biography about myself, early years growing up on the farm, things like that. And I've put in there quite a few stories. And the stories there, Peter, if the astute reader, which I'm sure all the readers will be, they can pick up sort of like what makes Rod and how he ticks. And if I could just give you one example, when we were about 16 years of age, we had a driver's license and we were driving an old car, and my mate was driving it, and we decided or debated whether to go down this steep hill, and at the bottom there was a sharp right-angle bend. And this was old car, 1939, which had cable brakes. So we debated for a while, and then, as only young kids do, yeah, let's do it. So we went over the crest of this hill, and he put his foot on the brake, and next minute you hear twang, and you know that's a cable gone. Now, if you know cable brakes, yep. You know, you lose one, you've lost everything.
Yeah.
And he said, shit, what'll I do? And I said, steer into the bank. So he steered in the bank. At this time, we were probably only going 3-4 miles an hour, something like that. So we went in there. He reversed back up. I had a rock in front of the wheel in case he stalled because we've got no brakes. Mm. Reversed back up the top of the hill, went to the farmer's fence with a pair of side cutters, cut about 12 inches of plain wire and fixed the brakes up and drove home. But I put that in because yes, it's funny. But it also shows, there's two or three of these stories in there to show my, what I like to think is my thinking ability, is how I didn't have to, like at that time, 16 years of age, I didn't have to say, oh, gee, it's John, what are we going to do here? It's not looking good. I just said, quick as a flash, I remember steering in the bank. And there's two or three other stories like that. So when the ditching came, you just call on all this experience, and you know, I wouldn't say instantaneously, but you know very, very quickly what you've got to do and how to do it.
Well, it's been absolutely fascinating, Rod. I feel for you and the challenges you've had since there, but I suppose the positive thing that came out is you saved all those people's lives. And I really look forward to reading the book. I'm going to pre-order a copy. But what I would like to do is to thank Andy Wright, because Andy introduced you to us. So very grateful to listener Andy Wright for that introduction.
Andy's a marvellous guy. He really is. We've caught up at trucking shows, aviation, and yes, he's a lovely guy, lovely family. So I thank you too, Andy. Very much appreciated.
Right. Well, that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. You can find Extended now on all the podcast players and, of course, on iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. You can find me, I'm Nascot Hornet, on Twitter and on our Facebook page, of course. That is Aviation Extended. You can also find me on the Aerospace Podcast Group and on Facebook. Rod, can we find you on social media anywhere?
Yes, I'm on Facebook, obviously, as From Hero to Zero, - Captain Rod Lovell. I think I'm also on these other ones, but I'm not too sure.
You are on Twitter. I'll put a link in the show notes so people can connect up with you. And you're a pretty approachable guy, so I'm sure you'd be more than happy to answer any questions anyone has.
Exactly. No, thank you very much, Peter. Thank you for all your help, support, and it's been great chatting with you.
No, I really enjoyed it. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Rod.
Goodbye, Peter. Thank you very much.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosions in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended.
This is XTP Media.